Good evening and welcome back to Editing Aloud. The sixth democratic elections have come and gone and talk has now turned to the new cabinet, which President Cyril Ramaphosa is set to appoint in the next couple of weeks after he's been inaugurated as the country's new president. Now, this morning at the Goldman Sachs conference, President Ramaphosa said he would indeed reconfigure the cabinet, as he's promised, and he would, in fact, announce the structure of the cabinet before he announced the people. Genevieve, does that surprise you that he's going to talk about structure before he talks about who's going to be in those posts?
In a way, because I'm thinking of timelines, actually. He's being inaugurated on the 25th of May. Before that, next week, the MPs get sworn in Parliament. He's part of that. So he steps down as an MP because then they do the election of the President in the National Assembly. So then inauguration on the 25th. And as far as we understand, the announcement of Cabinet will be on Monday the 27th. So when does he want to announce the structure?
Yeah, well, we'll be waiting.
Is it going to
be
before they even sworn in as MPs?
Next week.
Is it the Sunday after inauguration? Is it at his inauguration?
Generally, there's been talk of cutting the size of the cabinet to 28, or I've heard as little as 25 ministries. Is that going to happen?
So, from everyone I've spoken to, Cyril seems to be playing his cards very close to his chest. No one's quite sure on the number. So everyone knows, yes, he said he's going to cut it and it's going to be cut. But no one actually knows by how much. There hasn't been any set figures. Even these lists of potential cabinet appointments that are going around, I don't think we can. I think you must take everything with a pinch of salt, because it does sound like, and from people close to him have even said, they don't even know the exact details of it. He's playing his cards very close to his chest. And that's why I think we're not actually going to see any real leaks out of this, unless someone is really close to the president and manages to get the information. So that's what I'm saying. I think we need to take everything we're hearing and reading right now with a pinch of salt. And when I say reading, I mean when you're getting lists on social media and on Twitter and Facebook, etc.
Look, Kanyo, how much do the numbers actually matter? I mean, are you worried about how many people are in the cabinet, or what kind of people are in the cabinet, or what posts are in the cabinet? What are you looking for?
I mean, the numbers thing is important. Obviously, it's important in terms of getting a more, more capable or more efficient state. I mean, if you look at the numbers, I mean, I think our cabinet is bigger than India's. And our population is not nearly as big as India's. And we all know, in the Zuma era, the state cabinet expanded, not to increase or improve efficiency, but also just to reward people and create patronage networks. So it was not really about efficiency and getting right departments to do the right things that needed to be done to get the economy going. So that's more important, maybe more than the numbers, but the numbers are important. I mean, if you look at the chart, doesn't look good. I mean, there's no way this country needs so many cabinet ministers. I mean, you got what? Economy, finance department, economic development, trade and industry, small business. Is there anything else I'm missing?
Samantha, which posts are you watching? And are you?
Well, obviously, the finance minister is a key portfolio. I mean, there has been speculation that Tito may not remain in the post, but again, that's all very kind of up for debate. But just to follow on from what Lakanya said, I mean, it is really about who is going to be in those posts, as opposed to, I think, the size. Although the size of the cabinet will send, if it's a smaller cabinet, will send a good message, I think, to citizens that the government is serious about kind of curbing its costs. Although cutting the cabinet itself will not have a huge impact on state spending. But yes, the people who are in those positions, capable people, is who we need.
Sikonati, the president said again this morning that he is committed to growth and he will be focusing on growth. And he made that connection between the kind of structure of the new cabinet and his set of priorities. You have written a column in this week's Financial Mail, you know, asking, can Cyril deliver? Whatever he promises, what are his chances of delivering?
Look, the fact of the matter is he has to work within that collective. That's a relic from Jacob Zuma, where he pretended he was making his colleagues in the NEC choose, when actually it was his bosses in Sachsenwald that were making the choosing. Now, Cyril, if he is to deliver, he must take back the power as bestowed on the president by the constitution and go and say, okay, guys, here are my 25 members or 20 members. But something really radical would be 15 cabinet ministers. Why do we need 20? Why do we need 25? You see, it's making Genevieve a joke. why do we need 25? If Cyril can deliver, if he is to deliver, the first thing, impressions count more. If he just sends the signal, like we will have 15 cabinet ministers, of course that's extreme in the South African context. It's not going to happen because the comrades still need the jobs or they will fire him. So he may not deliver.
And Cyril needs to take responsibility for this cabinet because it's no longer the cabinet he inherited from Jacob Zuma. And so he was a little, you know, he's not going to remove everyone. He's got the decision he makes, and it goes back to our conversation about who makes it onto the cabinet. He is going to have to take responsibility for who he puts on that cabinet. If he's telling us competent people who do their job, who are vision forward-looking, well, then he really has to walk the talk.
Exactly. As soon as he appointed the current cabinet last year, I had been talking to him about a few other things. He quickly sent me a message and said, this is just a transitional cabinet. So you can already see that he knew that was not going to cut it. This time he's got absolutely
no excuse.
He is the president.
This is his cabinet.
Yes, it's his cabinet, and he is the president. The Constitution says you, Mr. President,
well, he will, be after
will choose any number of people. He must just take. So the message here is, is he willing to go all the way and restore confidence and indeed deliver growth, cut costs? There's one other thing that we have not spoken about since it was mentioned once, that Parliament would be moved up to Pretoria. Mm. Remember when we were desperate to avoid a junk rating? He has to announce a timetable about when Parliament will move up.
Oh, it seems to me like there's so much work to do. I wouldn't have put that at the top of my list of priorities, but yes. I mean, in a way, surely one's looking to him to set priorities. There's a laundry list of stuff that's been promised. But he seems to be signaling growth is it, jobs is it. He actually said, I think today, what keeps me awake at night is jobs. And in fact, on this subject, yesterday's unemployment numbers, Lucanio, for the first quarter, very distressing, actually. Mm. What did you make of 28% unemployment?
But then I suppose these numbers have been dreadful for many years. I mean, it's not like, you know, we've gone from 15 last week to 25, whatever it is. But I think that the point is that we're going in the wrong direction. And I mean, coming like 2 or 3 days after the elections, or three or four days before he actually starts his administration, and it's almost like a wake up call to sort of, wake up call is the wrong word because I'm sure he knows how big the crisis is, but I think it's just
shocked by the numbers.
So like, I know he was always shocked, but I'm sure he wasn't shocked by this one. I think it sort of just highlights what he needs to do and how quickly he needs to act, because to make any kind of dent on this, I mean, he can't be the president that we've been talking about so far, the one who's about consensus, the one who's about agreeing everything with every union in the country. I know Sibonacci has written a lot about the teachers' unions, for example. And I mean, he just needs to show himself to be decisive. I think presidents, politicians, they bit like football managers. Their careers peak very quickly. It's going to go down from here.
So he
needs to act now. I think that is one of Mbeki's biggest mistakes.
You start off with a really terrible unemployment figure, and in a way, it gives you, as bad as it is, it should be a base onto which you can show that you can turn it around. I mean, Sam, what are the chances that in a year's time, those numbers look at least a little better?
I think a year might be a bit optimistic, but certainly we need more policy certainty in certain areas. Agriculture SA was saying today that the job losses in agriculture are indicative of the policy uncertainty they feel, their members feel, around land reform. So, I mean, that issue is still very much up in the air. How is land reform going to be resolved, which is obviously an important issue that we need to address.
Construction also was hit hard.
We need to start building. We need investment in infrastructure. Yeah. And that hopefully will provide jobs for relatively sort of unskilled young people, because that's where the unemployment rate is showing its kind of worst numbers, on youth unemployment.
Sikonathi, what do you see as... what are the chances that we can start turning that unemployment crisis around?
Look, like Samantha says, looking short term is actually a bit too optimistic. Let's measure the success or otherwise of the new administration in 2 years' time. Of course, we don't have 2 years. An unemployment rate of 38%. Forget the official rate of 27.6.
The expanded rate is 38%.
The real unemployment rate is
38%. People have given up looking for work.
Yes. That's the real unemployment rate, and it's too embarrassing for the government. Hence, they have the official one. That's too high a rate. More than a third of able-bodied people who could be working are not working. Now, do we have in this country people... a turnaround strategist, because that's what you need. You need a government that can come and disrupt the situation, turn everything upside down. And I'm talking now about the Labour Relations Act and such things, and ignore the workers, ramp up investment in electricity, infrastructure and everything. You don't have such people, certainly in the lot going to Parliament. You have them in business, you have them everywhere. Cyril Ramaphosa can find those people, but he's never going to put them in cabinet because his comrades won't allow him to.
Jeff Radebe has been doing, sort of acting fast, whether he's staying in the cabinet or not, Genevieve, I don't know if you have a view on that, but his latest announcement is that he's going to allow something which people have long called for, which is embedded generation, the ability to put a solar panel on your roof, be you a business or a household, and feed it into the grid. Now, we can talk about the broader electricity issues after the break, but are you surprised by the sort of sudden enthusiasm from Minister Radebe to get all sorts of things in place, Genevieve?
No, not really. But let's also, Jeff Radebe is one of the ministers that for some reason has been able to withstand everything that's happened in the last 10 years. He's just like the man who won't go away. Yes. And so I don't know. I think he is going to stay on the cabinet, maybe not in the position that he's currently in. And again, I just don't see him going anywhere. But I think a lot of people are trying to prove we are those forward-thinking visionaries that the president wants on his cabinet. We will perform. And so
do you think we're going to see a lot of stuff in the next week about people who hope that somebody will keep them there?
Quite possibly. Although the next week is going to be busy, though, in terms of parliament, because Wednesday is the swearing-in of the MPs. Then everyone goes into an induction, 2 weeks of induction, 2 weeks then for the portfolio committees. Because remember, when Cyril reannounces his cabinet, the portfolio committees in Parliament are going to have to be realigned with the cabinet's positions. And that still has to go to rules committee. So there's a lot to happen in Parliament before we go to SONA in June.
Talking about embedded generation, Sikonathi, what is the significance of this? Can it help us with the electricity crisis? Does it start to open up the market? Is allowing people to generate their own electricity and feed it into the grid, is that privatization?
The question about whether it is privatization or not is really not the question that we should be concerned about. The reality of the matter is we need as much electricity as we can get, and the sun is shining upon us. So it's the progressive thing to do. We generate power and feed it into the system. That generates money for the private user, be it a company, a building like ours here or at home. And it helps Eskom get more electricity. Yes, it is privatization because you and I will be generating our own power. Is that bad? Not at all. That's the progressive thing to do. Many developed countries have been doing it for a very long time. Why haven't we been doing it?
The interesting thing, and I have a little tiny solar panel on my roof. Now, that is that much less I'm paying the municipality in terms of electricity tariffs, and it is pretty minute. If everybody's doing it and doing it at scale, does that not worsen Eskom's financial problem? That's a kind of classic utility death spiral where it becomes feasible to actually generate your own rather than buying from
it. It actually gives Eskom the capacity to maintain and fix once and for all their power stations. The one thing to remember about Eskom, it's got about 5 power stations that are at average age 50. that should already have been decommissioned, but it cannot decommission those stations before it has a sufficient generating capacity. And now it did a shoddy job of Medupi, Ingula and Kusile. It needs as much power as it can get, and this is the quickest way to get that investment going. It's even quicker than the formal IPP processes that they have been running, because everyone can get a solar and put it on there, and the meter runs the other way around, and you get credits instead of waiting for a round of solar power to be built somewhere in the Northern Cape.
Don't you need quite a, I mean, this is quite a radical shake-up in the market.
I think it could be implications for city councils who rely heavily on the revenue that they earn from electricity sales. And as we know, the margin that they put onto electricity sales, that money isn't necessarily reinvested in electricity infrastructure. It often goes to fund other services.
And that money doesn't even go back to Eskom.
Yes.
The portion that should go to Eskom.
And it will be mostly probably upper middle class homes who are already heavy users of electricity, who are likely to be able to afford.
Or businesses
to generate their own electricity. So the impact on city councils could actually be potentially quite severe. I'd be interested to hear what they have to say about this plan.
Well, I wouldn't give a toss about city councils. They're already collecting the money now, and they're not paying over to Eskom. Mm-hmm. And the councils are collapsing anyway.
Well, some are.
If we're talking about big metros. I'm sure big metros are paying them.
There you go. You can't give me one. That's how bad they are. Yes, of course, there are indeed some that are paying. But the fact of the matter is, the people cannot be held hostage to the maladministration and the local administration. That's the most important part. It frees up the people who are willing to. I mean, you have industries that cannot operate because they don't have electricity. And even if you have the ability to generate your own power under the current regulations, you can't. So this is a very progressive move indeed by Jeff Khatebe.
But Lukanya, is anyone thinking about what the implications are for the system as a whole?
Now that you mentioned it, I was thinking, like, now our colleague Lisa Stein wrote about this a couple of months ago. Now, to talk about a death spiral, and she was saying, like, exactly, to people talk about the death spiral, they're talking about Eskom itself. And she actually did look into the thing, well, what implications for the local councils. And the fact that they're just going to have to change their business model, so to speak, like any business that's being disrupted, because you're not going to regulate yourself out of this. I mean, there's only one way it's going to go. The question is, are you going to survive, or are you just going to sit around and waiting for somebody to somehow artificially find some kind of remedy that's not actually going to work in the end? Because no, with these forces, you can't stop them. You can delay them for a while.
Yeah. Talk about delays, Genevieve. I mean, there seems to be actually no movement on Eskom. There was a whole lot of action that was promised on restructuring and whatever in the State of the Nation address, in fact, as far back as December. What is the holdup? Have you got any sense of what are the politics around the decisions being made on Eskom?
Well, I think for now what we've got to remember, we've just come out of an election campaign, and so everyone's focus, political parties, and has been on elections, winning elections or growing your support or whatever. So, and now we're moving on to the positions in Parliament. So I do think that the Eskom matter has maybe taken a bit of a back seat. Again, we go back to Cabinet. We're waiting to see, does Pravin Gordhan come back as the Public Enterprise Minister? Is someone new coming in? So I think things are very much up in the air. Is there a new Finance Minister? Is there not? Because after Tito Mboweni was talking about a budget in terms of how they would help Eskom, the certain conditions, will a new Finance Minister feel the same? So I think you can't really, I know it's important, I know that there shouldn't be such a lag, but I think because we're getting into a new administration, I think there is going to be a bit of a lag until we know for certain who's in certain positions, and then only be able to move forward from there. That's my sense. I'm not sure if someone has a different...
So we're sort of all a bit paralyzed at the moment.
I think so. I think we're just...
waiting.
We've got to go through now the process of starting a new administration, and we can't jump that gun.
The budget was quite explicit in the timelines that they had for Eskom. I mean, they wanted to set up the transmission company by June as a legal entity. As you know, they mentioned the chief reorganization officer, which was a condition of Eskom receiving more funding. Nothing's happened. So I think it is disappointing that there has actually been no movement.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder kind of how serious they really are.
I think
contested the whole thing really is.
I suppose maybe you also get complacent with Eskom because we've had power load shedding for a couple of months, and because we're burning all this diesel, and we think everything is great. But if you look, there was an interesting article on Bloomberg this morning where they've actually done some analysis of some of the numbers that are out there in terms of the bond markets. I mean, we've always talk about Eskom's debt being at 400 billion, whatever it is. They were actually saying this morning it's closer to 500. So it's time that we're sitting around pretending everything is fine or trying to like worry about the politics. That mess is getting bigger by the day. I mean, if the numbers are correct, now it's 500 billion from, say, 420, whatever it was when the last had results. What do you think is going to be when next time they have results?
I'm going to turn now to something a little bit more leisurely. Sam Entland, you've been looking at Airbnb and Cape Town's efforts to regulate Airbnbs. Now, what is this about, and what kind of signal does this send in terms of our efforts to attract more tourism?
Well, it's actually a national plan. So the Tourism Amendment Bill was issued a few weeks ago, and the plan is to regulate short-term rentals. So they don't actually stipulate what they're thinking of, but in other cities, for example, London, Paris, New York, there are limitations on the number of nights you could actually rent out a room or your home. So, for example, in London, there's a 90-day rule. And once you've reached the 90-day rule, then your home gets taken off Airbnb. So various cities around the world have adopted different approaches. In Santa Monica in California, you have to have a business license. And they also levy a 14% tax on Airbnb rentals. So it's unclear yet what's going to happen in South Africa. People have been very upset about this. I have a contrary view where I think actually Airbnb rentals should be regulated. I think there should be a level playing field in the tourism industry, and obviously while the hotel industry has a lot more muscle, they've also invested a lot and they also employ a lot of people. They also have to comply to various sort of health and safety regulations. So I'm not suggesting that Airbnb hosts should have to comply necessarily with the same level of regulation that hotels have to comply with, but I do think there needs to be some monitoring of it. And I think I'm in the minority.
I certainly would disagree totally with that. What we do need in this country is create as much opportunity as possible for people to make money, to get income. What Airbnb does need to do is to be taxed. Mm. That's all that you need to do.
So Airbnb does pay tax, but it's whether their hosts pay tax.
That's what I'm talking about. So yeah. the hosts need to pay tax. Yes. That's the only intervention you need to have. And leave business alone. There's a lot that needs government, and government is failing to do. What the government should be doing in terms of tourism, make it even easier for people to come into this country and use those as Airbnb establishments and then tax them.
But
you
then
don't
what
need
about
to
it,
interfere in their business.
So what about the hotel industry then?
The hotel industry, we were talking now about disruption when it comes to electricity. Why should they be immune from disruption?
Can I also add to that, Sipunati's point? I mean, like, people also make this comparison with international trends, but the things that when you compare Europe to South Africa, it's not the same thing. In Europe, it's really about people not having access to homes, and they're pushing up the prices, and young people and pensioners and people on lower income not being able to actually afford homes, where you've got a shortage of homes on those markets. But I don't think in Cape Town you've got that problem. We have a housing shortage in this country, but those people are not competing with Airbnb, you know, like sort of landlords or landladies, whatever. What's a PC term nowadays?
Jane, you were nodding frantically. Do you have? Are you an Airbnb user? Do you have a view?
I have used it. I agree with Sikonati, actually.
Just open it up.
Open it up, and it does give opportunity, business opportunity, and like you said, pay a bit of tax and let business carry on.
In fact, in South Africa, it always feels to me that these disruptors have all opened new markets. Mm. In fact, a lot of the existing operators have resisted like crazy. I mean, it feels to me like whole new markets have been opened up by the Ubers and the Airbnbs.
Yeah, but aren't they also making it back to Airbnb easier for people to travel because it's cheaper? Some people can't afford to pay 2,000 rand a night to stay in the southern sun, but they can afford to pay 500 rand a night to stay in an Airbnb. So it also opens the opportunity maybe for more people to travel.
Going directly to the pocket of entrepreneurs again. That's what we need in this country. You need it to make it as easy as possible for people to make money. Just charge them tax, that's all.
We've got a couple of minutes left, and in that couple of minutes, this is what I want to do, give Ife, Cyril Ramaphosa's inauguration is days off, and his first State of the Nation address is just a month off, really. Very quickly, what would you want to headline in that Sona?
State of the Nation.
State of the Nation.
Just no, he like could. You know what?
One or two takeaways.
He could even read the one he did last year because I don't know. Like,
just tell him how much.
Maybe he could just say, "Look, I'm not going to read you one. Now all the things I said last year, I'm now going to do them. From like immigration law to you name it, it's all that. it just needs to get done."
Exactly. Jane, quickly.
I think he's going to announce the head of that new NPA directorate.
Okay. Sam, what's your
He has mentioned this already, but I would like to see people prosecuted for corruption.
What I want him to do is put a target on economic growth. We're going for 5% and we'll do it.
That is an ambition. And on that cheerful note, please join us again next week for the next edition of Editing Aloud.